I've tried to organize some thoughts to plan an agenda for myself, this Elo, and ask myself the kinds of questions that I'm certain I've asked myself before and that the rest of us have confronted before. Let me just review briefly what it is that makes Elo special, and then go on to ask the kinds of questions that the introduction virtually begs. Historically, the reason that Elo is significant is because it was on Rosh Chodesh Elo that Moshe Rabbeinu ascended to Har Sinai for his third visit. He was there previously twice, each time for 40 days. The first time when the Torah was first given, when he came down with the first Luchos, which of course he shattered, when he discovered that Kol Yisrael was worshipping the golden calf. The second time began on the 18th day of Tammuz. He went up again to plead for Hashem's forgiveness for the chait of idolatry. And he was there again for 40 days, 40 nights. He came down on the last day of Av, went up again on Rosh Chodesh Elo, and then he stayed until Yom Kippur. He came down on Yom Kippur holding the second Luchos, which were then ensconced in the Aron. The day after Yom Kippur, he gave instructions to the building of the Mishkan as a sign that the Ribbono Shel Olam had forgiven Klal Yisrael for the Chet HaEdel. So, because these 40 days, the last 40 days, were Yimei Rotzei, these were days in which Klal Yisrael, for some reason, found favor in the sight of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, found favor in God's eyes. So, these are days that we set aside for tshuva, hopefully to culminate, as it did then, on this last day, which became, for the rest of history, just as it was then, Vayemer Hashem, Rashi says, that it was on that last day that Hashem Yisbarach said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "Vayemer Hashem, Salachti Kidvarecha, I will forgive them as you've pleaded, as you've requested." So we too hope that the segment of time is going to end as it did then. These are days of favor, our tshuva, our penitence, our regret, our resolve is all going to find favor in Hashem Yisbaras eyes, and consequently we are going to be forgiven on Yom Kippur. That's, so it's all this time is all like one body of time. It's one entity of time, these 40 days. Interestingly, out of these three segments of 40 days, the first 40 days were days in which the fortunes of Klal Yisrael were soaring. These were Yimei Rotzei. These were days of great intimacy between Hashem and His people. And these last 40 days, we are told, like the first 40 days, were Yimei Rotzei. These were days in which Hashem was very close to Klal Yisrael. The middle 40 days were the Kas. These are days of anger, days of wrath. We need to understand what it was that was different about the last 40 days and the middle 40 days. Why was it? And in either event, Moshe Rabbeinu was certainly looking for atonement for Klal Yisrael, and yet the middle 40 days, for all of his petitions and appeals, Klal Yisrael was not forgiven. It was only the last 40 days. So we need to understand, in the first instance, what happened. Question is intensified somewhat, because at the conclusion of those 40 days, before Moshe Rabbeinu went up for the last segment of time, God said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "Psalacha, bring up some stone, and I'm going to give you the luchos." So something had happened over that 40-day period. Something had changed, because he was not at the beginning of that period of time prepared to give Klal Yisrael a second set of luchos. At the end of that period of time, he was. So if he was prepared, then something dramatic occurred throughout that 40-day period. And if that's the case, then why didn't he give him the luchos on the first day? Why did he have to wait there for 40 days? If at the very beginning Hashem had already recognized that there was some tshuva, because he ordered Moshe Rabbeinu to take up the stone from which he was going to give him the luchos eventually, so something had changed. And if it had changed, so why didn't he give it to him right away? What did the last 40 days add that one needed to wait over that 40-day period before allowing the actual luchos to be given to Klal Yisrael? On the last day, the day that we celebrate as Yom Kippur, because of the fact that Hashem forgave Klal Yisrael with simcha, with joy, with the fullness of forgiveness, Hashem instructed Moshe Rabbeinu as a sign of that forgiveness to command Israel in the building of the Mishkan. The Mishkan then was a symbol of Hashem's forgiveness. But it's not total forgiveness, because Hashem is already recorded in the Torah of Yom Pakti Ufakadati. Moshe Rabbeinu Metzachob Rechnen. When, as time passes, when Klal Yisrael individually, collectively does what they should not do, then I will then spend my wrath. I will punish Klal Yisrael for this chait, along with the other things that they will do during the rest of the course of history. So, if the tshuva was good enough to build the Mishkan, why wasn't it good enough that they could be totally reinstated? Why somehow is this tshuva compromised? It is good, it's not good. It's Solachti Kimilrecho, as the Chazal say, it was done with the fullness of Hashem's forgiveness and the Simcha, and yet it's not enough to restore them to their former position. There's a minhag that on Rosh Chodesh Elul that we begin the sounding of the shofar. And the Torah says at the very beginning of Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, when he talks about the way in which we're to conduct ourselves during Elul, he says that the reason for this is because during the third 40 days, when Moshe Rabbeinu went up, just before he went up, he sounded the shofar, or ordered that the shofar be blown, as a message to Klal Yisrael that they should not make the mistake that they made the first time, that they shouldn't err and be swayed by idolatry as they were the first time. That's the case, that there is somehow that Shofar represents some sort of a, transmits some sort of a message that they shouldn't follow the Avodah Zarah, then why didn't Moshe order that the shofar be blown before the second 40 days that he went up? He didn't. The shofar was not sounded. It was only sounded the third time, for the third period of time. What happened? What about the second time? Why not sound the shofar the second time? If you have to tell Klal Yisrael, don't make this mistake again, tell him the second time before you go up. It doesn't do it. It's only the third time, because he did it on Rosh Chodesh, the morning of Rosh Chodesh. So we do it on Rosh Chodesh. Except we continue doing it. And then, of course, we need to ask ourselves, why did it have to be the shofar? Could have been a chatzitz, could have been a trumpet, could have been, I'm assuming, from everything that's said, that somehow the shofar is specifically the instrument that has to carry this message. The other thing that maybe should be of some concern to us is that when you look at the whole picture, Elul derives its significance because of a rather private, a very personal kind of a relationship between Hashem Yisbarach, between God and Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu went up to the mountain, and he petitioned, and he appealed, and he prayed for Klal Yisrael's forgiveness. So because Moshe Rabbeinu, who was a very unique person of unsurpassed greatness in the history of Klal Yisrael, transcendent good. Nobody else can really become Moshe Rabbeinu. So because Because Moshe Rabbeinu had this thing going with Hashem Yisrael, so all of Klal Yisrael does things. Where do we come in? How do we relate to the fact that the rest of Klal Yisrael wasn't in on this petition? The rest of Klal Yisrael wasn't in on this 40-day period of intimacy with Hashem Yisrael. So it relates. It's a private thing between. So maybe every generation, Elul should be relevant to the Gadol Hadayah, to the luminary of the generation, if we could figure out who that would be. But what does it have to do with everybody? And it's clear that Elul is equally relevant, equally demanding of every serious Ben Yisrael, Bas Yisrael. Then again, a number of other interesting points that come to our attention. Each one of the periods in which Moshe Rabbeinu went up to the mountain was 40 days. What's the significance of 40 days? Why couldn't it have been some other number? We are also told in a Maim HaChazal, which is very well known, that the Mokaim Shebal Yitshuva Imdin, place occupied by those who are repentant, those who have strayed from Hashem's way and have come back, that somehow the place which they come to occupy is Ein Tzadikim Gemurim Chalam. That's something that even those people who have been perfectly righteous, they cannot stand in the place attained by, assumed by, the Bali Chu. How are we to understand? Finally, what are the questions of Elul? Generally speaking, what are the questions that we ask ourselves? Or we believe legitimately we should be asking ourselves during Elul. During Elul we should be saying to ourselves, what do I need to do? How do I need to improve? I know that I am flawed, I am blemished, I am imperfect because of the things that I have done in the past. I've made mistakes, I've committed chatoyim and avoynos and pshoyim. How can I reinstate? Those are generally the questions that we believe are legitimate during this period of time. And my question is, are those the right questions? Talk for a moment about what, talk a lot about transgression, talk about chatoim and avoynos, sin. What do they mean? I'm going to use some shocking examples, so to try to illustrate a point. First, let's start out. You have a king. He has a domain. He has subjects. The subjects of his domain understand that the king has legislated certain laws, and that those laws are not meant to be broken for the welfare of the citizens or the subjects of the kingdom. That there's a code of conduct, and if you break those laws, then you do so at peril of being punished, depending on the severity of the violation, would be some sort of a commensurate consequence. So now, let's say the person does not break the law. Why does he not break the law? Because he doesn't want to suffer the consequences. Namely, he doesn't want to get clobbered. Because he doesn't want to get punished, because he doesn't want to suffer, therefore he will not break the law. And if he does, and in fact is punished, and you were to ask him, are you sorry? He would say yes. My brother, Aaron, my twin brother, we were much younger. We were the babies of the family. So my older brothers were sort of surrogate parents when we were growing up. And they helped, I think unsolicited, helped my parents raise us. So on one occasion, my brother committed some wrong, which my brother Mutti did not like. So Mutti decided to take things into his hands, and he patched them. Right? He smacked them up. So when in the midst of doing this, he said to him, my brother Aaron, he said to him, well, are you sorry? And Aaron was already quite clever at the time. He said, yes, I'm sorry. So he said to him, what are you sorry about? So Aaron said, I'm sorry that I have a brother like you. So if you were to ask this subject, are you sorry? He would say, yes, I'm sorry. You'd say, what are you sorry about? He'd say, I'm sorry about the fact that I'm getting punished. His servitude or his being a subject is not a factor in his committing the crime. He committed the crime because for some reason it interested him. It appealed to him to commit the crime. The fact that he is an eved, the fact that he is a servant, the fact that he is a subject, is not what made him commit the crime. You might say that were he a better sort of person, he might not be an eved. So that somehow his lowly status is at once what brings him to commit the crime and to be regretful in the way in which he is. But the fact is that it is not his avdus per se which brings the crime upon him. Now let's talk about the other extreme, the prince. Prince goes out and he commits a crime. It's a crime, it's not a princely crime. In other words, something that a prince shouldn't do. This is a crime that the lowliest peasant shouldn't do. So he commits a crime. Let's say he goes out and he sees something that he likes, some jewelry or something, and he steals it. Or, let's take something worse yet. He sees a woman and he desires that woman and he forces himself upon that woman. If we can, try to look into this prince's head for a few minutes. How did this happen? He does something which virtually no subject, no eved, no servant would allow himself to do. Why does he do it? He does it because he's a ben melech. He does it because he believes that as the prince, that he can operate with impunity. Because he is the prince, his father loves him, so he can do whatever. He's a privileged character. He can do whatever he wants. Even if it means to participate in something which is the pits of degradation, nonetheless, he believes that he has somehow the latitude to do as his heart desires. In this case, his being a ben melech, his being a prince, is the cause of his chet. Unlike the eved, unlike the subject who commits a crime, where it's his appetite, not his status, it is this status itself which is the cause for the crime. Now we have, by the way, we have a precedent. If somebody says, Echtavosh, somebody says, I will sin and I will do tshuva. In other words, there's a guy who's going along and he decides that he wants a McDonald's cheeseburger. So, can't resist it, but something says it, but you know, you're committed not doing this. It's wrong. You believe that this is wrong. So he says, yeah, it's okay. I'll do it, and then I'll do tshuva. He knows that there's tshuva, so he's got it all figured out. He's going to enjoy the cheeseburger, then he's going to do tshuva. So Chazal tell us it doesn't work. That ain't must speak in the other. Heaven will not accept. They will not allow him to do tshuva. They won't accept his tshuva. That's an unacceptable form. Why? Because it's the presence of tshuva that allows it to happen. If there would be no tshuva, this guy wouldn't sin. If there would be no such institution, no such mechanism of being reinstated through penitence, then this person would have stopped. He would have said, I can't do this. I can't do it because if I commit this wrong, I will be forever in God's disfavor. So it turns out that tshuva is that which makes him sin or allows him to sin. So now they will not allow him to avail himself of that mechanism to reinstate himself because it has been the responsible provocation for the chet. Similarly, if it turns out that the reason that the prince committed the wrong is because he is the prince, then he cannot be allowed any longer to be the prince. Because it is that position of power that he has abused. He has abused his relationship with the melech, and in fact has used the authority of the throne to commit his wrong. Let's look for a moment at how the prince feels now. The king finds out that he has done this despicable act. So he banishes the prince. He said to him, forget it. You are no heir to my throne. Get lost. I can't deal with you any longer as my child. So there might be any one of a number of levels of regret. His regret might be the same as the subject who gets punished. Namely, he is sorry because he got clobbered, because he's punished. And he may regret having acted so impetuously. That may bother him. He may, on a second level, he may upon reflection look back at what transpired and say, you know, I'm really disappointed. I thought that this was going to be, I was going to eat this cheeseburger, it was going to be gewaldic. I was going to have tremendous pleasure from this. I thought that this despicable act that I was going to do was going to bring me tremendous pleasure. You know what? It wasn't so terrific. Lasted for 30 seconds, it was gone, finished. It wasn't so terrific. It wasn't worth the price. So there, the regret is that it was just a big mistake. It was a disappointment. The experience was a disappointment. And he regrets having paid such a big price for something that was such a waste. He may realize, at a third level, that he abused his privileged status. And that might, in some way, be the source of his remorse. Or maybe even a more sophisticated thing is, fourth level might be that when he reflects on what transpired, he realizes that when he was doing what he was doing, that he felt cheapened, that he felt somehow that he was not what he should be. So he really felt out of sorts. He recognizes that when he was doing what he was doing, that he didn't like himself at the time. He didn't like himself. So he regrets having cheapened himself. He regrets having done something that made him feel like he didn't like himself. Now we can transport all of that, all of those feelings, to what happens when people commit whatever violation or transgression. They would also feel, in one instance they might feel it wasn't worth it. In another case, they might feel that they didn't like themselves when they was doing the chayit. They might have felt that they're paying a very big price for having acted so recklessly, whatever. Any one of those things might apply. So let's move on for a moment and ask ourselves, under what conditions would it be possible for Klal Yisrael or other certain significant people in Jewish history to have committed certain acts of wrongdoing, realizing who they were and what they were? In other words, question is, at Har Sinai, Klal Yisrael had reached a peak of spiritual development. There are my Mori Chazal that suggest the fact that they had transcended things such as death itself, that they were no longer really subject to the Yetzer Hara in the same way in which all of mankind was at that time, prior to that time, that they were no longer subject to Shibud Malchus. There would be no kingdom on earth that could ever rule over them. But there were other people who, like Adam in Paradise, or Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all people. How is it that they were able to to do some of the things that they did. So there's something which, I don't know what the word for it is, it's a form of intoxication. Feelings or states of being that are so strong that they do not allow a person to entertain the thought that there could be any other state of being. For example, one that we're all familiar with is life. Life is a state of being. And we are all very sensitive to that state of being. And it's such a powerful experience that to us, it's only something, if you think about it, it's only something that can happen to other people. It can't happen. Other people's life we don't sense. Therefore, it's possible that we should entertain the thought that somebody else's life might end. But our own life? Impossible. There's no way in which we can really seriously think about that. Because life is so powerful, it is so intoxicating, that we can't think of our not being alive. And people, because they are so intoxicated with life, make sometimes reckless decisions. They put their lives at risk because it's simply unthinkable to them that there might be anything that could take life away from them. People will make sometimes impetuous decisions about surgery. And they are absolutely certain that they will come out of surgery. Why? Because they can't. Life is such an intoxicating experience that it's unthinkable to them that it could end in during the course of an operation. So life is one of those feelings that denies its converse. To some extent, when people become too secure, they also become reckless. Certainly one dimension, at least of a very complicated series of events that surrounded Adam HaRishon in Gan Eden, Paradise, is the fact that he was so secure, so certain with where he was and who he was and his relationship with Hashem Yisbarach, that he felt totally at comfort in being able to try to dally with this other experience, the Eitz Hadas Teva Ra. He was, in a certain sense, prepared to have his cake and eat it. He was going to be in Gan Eden, and yet he was going to taste of the Eitz Hadas. Or Klal Yisrael. Precisely because they reached that level, they were so certain that this act of idolatry, whatever it represented, and it certainly did not represent crass idolatry, whatever it represented, they were so certain about their relationship. They had seen Hashem Yisbarach. They saw it. It was incontrovertibly clear, irrefutably clear, that there was a God in the world and that He was one and that He was perfect and all these other things. They were so secure in that knowledge that they felt that this ego would not in any way confuse the lines of authority, would in no way detract from their service of Hashem as well, and yet it would allow them certain luxury, certain latitude, certain liberty. So they failed to react to the ego. Shlomo HaMelech was the wisest of all men. And there's a pasuk in the Torah that says that the king, amongst other things, there are three things that the king is not supposed to do. One of them is he should not marry a great many women. And it says, the pasuk reads, "V'layabalei noshim v'layosu levova." He should not have many wives, and they will not, so that they should not turn his heart. Now here was Shlomo HaMelech, who was the wisest of all. You have to understand how profound that wisdom was. How translucently clear he was about all things in the world. When you read about the things that Shlomo HaMelech knew and understood in his wisdom, it's absolutely staggering. He knew, he could understand what blades of grass were saying to one another, what the birds were saying, what the trees were saying. He knew what every granule of earth was fit for. So Shlomo HaMelech, in his security and because of his clarity, was able to say to himself, "Ani abe v'layosu levo. I can afford to do it." Someone who's a lesser person, who doesn't have this grip on things, who lacks the clarity, okay, that could happen. But I, who have this perfect grasp, I know with such graphic clarity, I know with such explicitness where everything is, this is impossible. There is nothing that can cloud my wisdom. There's nothing that can obscure the clarity of my thoughts. So in my case, an exception is an order. Of course, exceptions are never in order, as we will address in a moment. But what we're looking at is this a certain strand that has really run across all of history. Eliyahu HaNavi, when he addressed Klal Yisrael and expressed his consternation and his exasperation with Klal Yisrael, said it in a way which has since become a virtual folk saying. How long are you going to try to straddle the fence? How long is it? Are you going to try to belong to Hashem Yisborach's Beis HaMikdash and the service of the Baal? How long are you going to try to belong to two worlds at once? The fact that people would like to, in what they believe is their right, to be anchored in one situation and to play and make sport in another is something which derives from the nature of man to take advantage of a certain security, a certain comfort, a certain hamishkeit, a certain clarity, and then say to himself, but I can do this and the other at the same time. Now let's talk about what's wrong with that. Why is that such a mistake? Why doesn't it work? Why, in fact, if Shlomo HaMelech has such clarity, why doesn't it prevent him from having his heart stray? How is it possible that someone who is as close, as intimate with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the Yetzir Kapov, the handiwork, God's handiwork, no other human being, was fashioned by Hashem Yisbach himself, that he should entertain the thought that he might at once be with Hashem on this side of the fence, and yet experience the Eitz Hadas on the other side? When we look at the feelings, looking before at the feelings of the prince, we looked at different levels of how he might feel. One of them is that the experience was a disappointment. It really wasn't what it was cracked up to be. And another was that he didn't like himself when he was doing it, and that's why he's regretful, because he really didn't respect himself at the time. He didn't like himself at the time. It cheapened him. But you see, what's wrong with all of this? And when we do this, we can do the same thing with chait, and we can have charata. Why do we have charata on a chait? We have charata because cheapness. We have charata because it wasn't worth it. There's something wrong here with it. First of all, we're focused on ourselves. The whole concern is I was cheapened. The concern is it was a disappointment to me. I didn't get out of it what I had envisioned, what my fantasy had painted that I was going to get out of this thing. Hypothetically, if the experience would not have been a disappointment, then it was worth it. Or hypothetically, if the person did not feel coarse and vulgar and cheapened in the process of doing the chait, then somehow, ostensibly, then it would have been okay. Then he would not have been so regretful. But let's assume for the moment that after the prince has gone through this period of time in which he asks himself, what did I do? And why do I feel the way I do? Why do I feel so rotten? So at first he says, I feel rotten because I abused my status. Not right. Then he says to himself, I feel rotten because the price was too much. This was a small chait and it was a big price. I feel rotten because I felt cheap. And then he says to himself, so what? Where does all of this derive from? What's the source of all of this? Where does this come from? Why do I feel cheap? Why was the experience such a disappointment? The insightful prince will reach the conclusion that the reason that this was so was not because there was anything wrong with the experience, and not because if it was a perhaps a more sophisticated chait, instead of stealing some jewelry, if he had perhaps embezzled it, then he wouldn't have felt so coarse. He wouldn't have been a cheap thief. Then he would have been a respectable thief. Then he would not have felt so demeaned in the process. He might respect himself. He did it cleverly. He somehow was able to make off with the millions of dollars of taxes because of the way in which he cleverly manipulated the computer. So he's really to be respected for how clever he was. He's not cheap at all. But the insightful prince will recognize that it's not the fact that he did something coarse, but that the dynamic behind the whole thing is that he betrayed his essence. That his essence is inextricably intertwined, attached to the melech. The will of the melech, the person of the melech, the essence of the melech is all something that makes up his own essence. The reason that he could not, no matter how wonderful the experience would have been, it never would have been enough. It wasn't because it happened to have been an ephemeral experience, an experience that lasted for moments. It wasn't because it was only something that was a bauble. It was because there is nothing in the universe, no matter how great, no matter how lasting, that could ever compare with the fact that when he did what he did, that he severed himself from his essence, that it was a betrayal of himself. That the only way in which he is anything is only when he is attached to, only when he is bottled to, only when he is completely submissive to, when he is an extension of the king. Then he is authentic, then he is true to himself. Otherwise, no matter what he does, no matter how sophisticated he does, no matter how cleverly, no matter how brilliantly he does it, he is going to feel cheapened. He is going to feel somehow rotten, because in doing what he did, in principle what he did, was severing himself from his makel, from his shedesh, from his root, from his origin. And in severing himself, he became something that was no longer himself. Life became at that moment totally, absolutely meaningless. And the focus turns from, not because I felt cheap, not because I didn't get out of this thing what I fantasized, but simply because I can't do this. Because the moment that I do it, I leave the king, and when I leave the king, I leave myself. That's it, I'm gone. It's all over. So he understands in one moment that he and the king are an inseparable, indivisible essence, and that he can no more sever himself from the king than he can sever himself from life itself. So, the reason that a chait is wrong, the reason that transgression is wrong, is not because we're afraid we're going to be punished, not because it wasn't worth it, not because we were cheapened by it, that because in the process we have severed ourselves from Hashem, His will, and we have severed ourselves from ourselves. In that state of being, nothing makes any sense. Initially, we find that Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Har Sinai to be taught the Torah, to be able to bring down to Klal Yisrael the Luchas. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, doesn't just go up to the mountain. He goes up, we are told, he goes up to heaven. And he is taught the Torah in heaven such that that he loses track of time. He knows that it's time only by what he learns. He knows that it's day because they learn Teresh B'Ksav. He knows that it's night because they're learning Gemara. He no longer has any need to sleep. He has no longer a need to eat, to drink. He is transported into another world. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu and Kol Yisrael are not two distinct entities. They belong to one another. And when Moshe Rabbeinu is up pushing the outer limits of human experience, of spiritual experience, there is something that is transmitted through the entirety of Kol Yisrael. Kol Yisrael knows that their frontiers are being, at this moment, are being pushed up. And they also know that they are attached in a way in which there could be nothing that would be stronger, clearer, better, finer, more sublime. At the same time, they recognize that here is a world of pleasure, a world of delight, a world of all kinds of appetite, a world of all kinds of desire. And they believe somehow that they are entitled, because of their security, because of the fact that they are attached in the way that they can, that they are somehow, that the license to also indulge the animal, symbolized by the ego, is something that that they can do simultaneously with being attached to Hashem. And of course, it becomes, as we've already described, an inherent contradiction. You can't at one and the same time be totally attached to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and totally severed. Because to take whatever step away, however minute, if it is a step away from Hashem Yisbach, it is a step in severance. And it becomes a betrayal to one's essence. It becomes an act of detachment from Hashem Yisbach. And we have to therefore recognize or learn the principle that was true of other Malishim in Gan Eden, and the principle that also addressed Kol Yisrael that they've made a catastrophic error, but they're trying to figure out what is the error. It takes time to reach the conclusion. It takes time to go through this transition and recognize what lies at the bottom. So they, at first, beyond any shadow of a doubt, said to themselves, it wasn't worth it. Look at what's happened to us. They wear crowns. They have to rid themselves of their crowns. They were no longer immune to Shibud Malchus. They were now going to be fair game for the different nations of the world. They were no longer going to be immune to the Malach HaMoves. They were going to be mortal again. Okay, and called them to Musa, the Pasuk says, I thought that I would make of you angels, and now you're going to be mortal. It wasn't worth it. They said to themselves, those little flings that transpired, the things that we did, they weren't worth it. We didn't get anything out of it. We didn't get out of it what we thought we were going to get out of it. And what's more, we fell cheaper than the price. Their regret at that point was the regret, or the sequence of remorse, which people go through when they committed a mistake, and they're not quite sure why they feel so terrible about it. At the conclusion of that 40-day period, a yetzirah had taken place. Because that period of time had passed, which they had reflected on, which they churned and chewed this thing through, they reached the conclusion that the reason that they felt the way they did was not because the experience wasn't worth it, and not because they felt cheapened, and not because the price was too small, but because they came upon that fundamental understanding that a person, a Jew, cannot take one step away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu without betraying the entirety of his essence, his connection with his ontological authenticity. Can't do it. You step away from yourself, you step away from everything that links you to reality. It's not real, and there is nothing in the world which is real. There is no price that's worth it. There is no experience which is worth it. There is no amount of COVID Which is worth it? Nothing. Everything becomes meaningless in the process of this act of severance and self-betrayal. Recognizing that Klal Yisrael has finally figured it out, Hashem Yisrael says to Moshe Rabbeinu, okay, Moshe Rabbeinu, now come up and I'm going to give you the second luchas. But he doesn't give him the luchas yet because it's only up here. They figured it out. But they have not yet transmitted it to the rest of their being. They understand it. But they need to live it, to practice it, to feel it, to sense it, so that it becomes something that suffuses the entirety of who they are and what they are. So we have as follows. We have the middle days, where Moshe Rabbeinu pleads the cause of Klal Yisrael, and they are Yimei Kas, because they are focused on all of the wrong things. They are regretful because of the fact that it wasn't what it cracked up to be. They are regretful because of the fact that they felt caught. All of the wrong reasons. These are Yimei Kas. But at the end of that period of time, the Yetzirah of 40 days has finally hit home, and they have now been transformed. So the next 40 days are Yimei Rotz. These are days now when Klal Yisrael now entertains a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Of course, there can be forgiveness, but to the extent that their very position was part of the reason that they committed the chait, they can no longer re-engage that position. It's an echt avashim situation. They can't be reinstated in the same way in which they were. What is available to them is that... for the reason that we said earlier, because it was their kinship which led them to the chait. However, the recognition of what it is that they did is such that now the Ribbono Shel Olam gives them the allowance. I won't bring you back to Gan Eden, but I will let you try to recreate Gan Eden. I won't lead you back to the state of princeship, but I will give you the wherewithal to recreate a royal being and a royal identity. And if then the person avails themselves of the means to do so, then ultimately the Ribbono Shel Olam will reinstate us at the end of time. Over this period of 40 days, the intellectual realization, the recognition, the flash of where it's all at becomes a living reality, becomes the sinews of their being, to the point where on the 40th day they become a legitimate kli, a legitimate vessel for Torah once again to become a living presence in their being. And that's the point at which Hashem says to them, okay, you understood, now there's been yet another Yetzirah. The Yetzirah, the creation, the shaping, the formation of an entity that knows in its heart and in its essence that their entire being, that life itself, is inextricably intertwined with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That any step from that is a step and an act of severance from oneself, as it is simultaneously a severance from the master of the world. Chiddush Yerim says, Sfasem is quotes to Chiddush Yerim, he says as follows, that the reason that Tzadikim Gemurim cannot occupy the position which is occupied by Bali Tshuva is much the same as taking a rope, and let's say you cut the rope, the rope tears. So when you want to again reattach the rope, you now make a very strong knot in it. If you were to look at that place in the rope before it was torn, its strength was, I don't know how you measure the strength of a rope, but whatever it is, it was numerically 50. But if you look now at the place where it was torn, and it is now a knot, that knot is much stronger than the strength of that rope at that place before. because it is now in this very, very strong now. So the strength of that connection is now more than it was before. And when we deal with this thing in terms of our experience or our perspective, the tzaddik gamur rightfully does not move away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but he doesn't know the horror, the emptiness. He doesn't know the feeling of betrayal of self and everything that is precious and perfect and sacred that the Baal Tshuva knows. Because the Baal Tshuva has experienced within himself the emptiness, the distance, the darkness, the bleakness, the pain of that self-betrayal, of living some grotesque lie, some ugly lie. And because they know it, the strength of that bond, the attachment, the intimacy, the clinging of that Baal Tshuva is one which, like the rope, at its point of connection, is a kesha which is manifold times stronger. Elo, Sfasemis tells us, again in the name of Disharim, is a name which has within it two words. There's a pasuk in Tilim, which we say, V'loy anachnu, he's going to say this, a part of Tilim that we say every day in the Dabri, he says, V'loy anachnu amu. So, the word V'loy has a kri and a ksi. It's written with an aleph, loy with an aleph, which means no, not. And when we say it, we are to pronounce it as though it were, not pronounce it, but think of it, as though it were written with a vav, meaning unto him, lo, unto him. So we could be saying, the word kri, V'loy anachnu amu, we are not his nation. Or we could be saying, V'loy anachnu amu, and unto him, we are his nation. So the Chiddushim says that in direct proportion, that it's V'loy anachnu, that we do not see ourselves as independent of Hashem Yisbara. To the extent that we negate self, that we negate the inclination to drift away from Hashem Yisbara's attachment, the extent that we do not see ourselves as experiencing ourselves separate from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to that same extent that it is V'loy anachnu, that we are not unto ourselves, it is V'loy anachnu, that's how strongly we are attached to Him. And he said if you take the word loy with an aleph and the word lo with a vav, and you put them together, those letters, with the permutation of the same letters, comes out to the word elo. Elo has aleph lamed meaning loy, and vav lamed with the lo with the vav meaning unto him. So this is a period of time in which what we're engaged in this word, in this month of Elo, is negotiating or navigating this move, this transition from the v'loy anachnu with the aleph to the v'loy anachnu as with the vav, attaching ourselves with a whole and indivisible attachment. The place that this is probably most personified is at the Akedah. Avraham Avinu has done everything in his life to give up every aspect of himself. He gave up his family, he gave up his friends, his social context. He became a wanderer, suffered all kinds of pain and discomfort when he was an old man. And at long last, towards the latter part of his life, he's blessed with a child who's to be the standard bearer of Klal Yisrael. He's given everything up, and now Hashem Yisbarach tells him to give up this child. Now he would be able to argue, he'd be able to say, I'm not going to do this. And he could also argue quite eloquently that he's not doing it for Hashem's sake. I can't sacrifice my son because Hashem, for your sake, then you'll have nobody. So I need to keep my son for your sake. So So he could have made a very cogent argument in refusing God's request. But his position was that even that assertion that I am going to do what I think is best, not for me, Hashem, but what is best for you, even that assertion deals with me as something independent of your will, because your will is that I should give up that which is best for you. That's what your will is, and I'm both. So the quintessential moment in history when you have this total submissiveness, this total attachment, where even where one could argue that the position that he would have taken would have been one of fidelity and one of championing the God's name in the world, at that moment we have the total surrender, the total immersion of man in Hashem Yisboch, in the knowledge that at the point at which, even in the best of cases, I wish to see myself as, in however subtle a way, independent of Hashem's Ratzon, at that moment life becomes utterly meaningless and ridiculous. My child doesn't mean anything to me at that moment. I have nothing which is more precious to me, which is dearer to me than my son. Because not only is he my son, but he also represents the future destiny of the world. He represents the Ratzon of Hashem Yisboch as it's to be manifest at the end of time. But even that is meaningless at the moment of severance. So, before Klal Yisrael had figured out what it was all about, what their regret was all about, why they felt so rotten having committed the Chet HaEgel, there was no point before Moshe Rabbeinu went up that second time for him to sound the Shofar, because the Shofar at that point didn't mean anything. It was only at the conclusion of that Yetzirah of the second 40 days when Klal Yisrael recognized that basic underlying truth that no Ben Yisrael can sever themselves however minutely from HaKadosh Baruch Hu without creating a total betrayal of self and essence. It's only at that moment, when that truth became understood throughout Klal Yisrael, that the Shofar could be sounded as a symbol and as a signal that Klal Yisrael had arrived at a truth which their forebear Avraham Avinu had come to understand at the conclusion of all his nisyonos. And when we say Ani L'Doidi V'Doidi Li, which is the acronym Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed, Ani L'Doidi V'Doidi Li, one of the things that we are saying, in addition to the fact, is that if there is a commensurate response from HaKadosh Baruch Hu as we reach out to him, but one basic thing that we are saying is that it's only when it is Ani L'Doidi, only when I have totally given myself over to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, only then can we understand that it will be V'Doidi Li. If there is any place in our lives where there is any reservation, any hesitance, any gap, any pause, any space between the Ani and the L'Doidi, there is no L'Doidi Li. L'Doidi Li is only applicable when it's Ani L'Doidi. I think it's fair to say that in each one of us, there is a configuration of all of Klal Yisrael. And that there's a little part of us which is a Moshe Rabbeinu. We find the Gemara many times that in the discussions between the sages, that one would say to the other when they were impressed by the logic of a certain argument, they say, Moshe Shapikam. The man's name was not Moshe, but because they represented at that moment a truth which was reflective of the Amitio Satero, so they referred to Moshe Shapikam. Moshe, you said very good. In each one of us there's a Moshe. There's a part of us which experience is a sphere that the rest of us is not completely privy to. The rest of us sort of struggles at the bottom of the mountain. We're struggling with not with the heavenly delights, but we're struggling with the Eitz HaDaas Tevara. We're in the Sevuvia, where Eir v'Choshech and Meshamshin Kachas, light and darkness, are both prevalent at the same times, and where we find ourselves drawn. And that part of us entertains this illusion that somehow we can be connected, that we can be who we are at our finest, because there are moments when we experience ourselves at our finest. We experience the Moshe Rabbeinu in us. We experience that part of us which is at the summit of Har Sinai. And yet, at the same time that we experience that sublime part of us, we're also experiencing these other parts of us that likes puff pastry or other whatever. Huh? Some puff pastries, even if it's kosher, it doesn't mean you have to become self-indulgent. So we're struggling here. We're struggling with our addictions. We're struggling, and all of us have addictions. They may not be to drugs. We have addictions. Each of us has an addiction. So we struggle with our addictions, and we struggle with our routine, and we struggle with our habits, and we struggle with our objects. So each of us has our different forms of bondage. And Elul is the time that, along with Klal Yisrael, we've just gone through a period. We've gone through the Shavasagatamas, the Dravach, and the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We've just been very shaken. We come to the realization that we're not at home, we're estranged, we're not rooted. Elul is the time when, like Klal Yisrael of old, each one of us recognizes at the threshold of Rosh Chodesh Elul that we've got to stop the charade. That we have to, we have to break the grip of this fraud. That there's too much of us that lives in a place in which life is meaningless. So, at this point, B'Shchei D'Shal comes along and we take hold of that Moshe Rabbeinu on us and we send them back up the mountain. We said to them, you know what, we understand this now. And now we want to experience the very best, the very finest that we can experience, so that we can recreate Har Sinai, we can recreate Gan Eden, we can recreate all the kinds of things that we can experience once again what it means to be a Ben Melech. We want to once again experience ourselves in our essence. Being free is only those people who are attached to the only entity which is free in the world, which is HaKadosh Baruch. As such, it would seem to me that the questions that we need to ask ourselves are not what do we need to do. The question that we need to ask ourselves, and by the way, it's a very fine line, the question we need to ask ourselves is, what does the Rebbeinu Shel Olam want us to do? If we stop for a moment and recognize how distant those two questions are from one another, I can ask myself, what do I want? What I want to do, might want to do, is I want to become a do-gooder. And I say to myself, so what should I do? I would feel very fulfilled if I wrote a book. I should write a book. I can think of things that would be a response to the question of what I should do. But I can tell you that the answer would come back very differently if I asked the question, what is the Ratzon of Hashem Yisbach that I should do? I'm going to come back with a totally different answer, because the Ratzon of Hashem Yisbach, God's will for what I should do, maybe, is likely to be in fact very different from the things that will tickle my fancy. The things that I would like to do because I assume that that's where I'm going to get a charge. We don't begin to recognize the exhilaration, the vitality that flows from connecting ourselves to a question which begins, what does the Rebbeinu Shel Olam want me to do? What the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants me to do may lead me to conclusions that affect how many hours I work, It may affect the way in which I deal with people. It may affect the number of hours that I learn, or what I learn when I learn. It can and should affect the entire scope of everything that I deal with. But if I ask the question as it deserves to be asked in Elul, not one which begins, which emanates from me, or which focuses on me, but which recognizes that the only time I am me, the only time that I am connected, the only time that I am authentic, is when I am attached to and subservient to and submissive to and immersed in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the only time in which I experience what it means to be a Melech, Eved Melech Melech. At that point, I begin to experience myself in the fullest, in the most exciting, and the most meaningful way. That's what life assumes meaning and purpose. And when I recognize that my life is traveling in the direction that it's meant to travel. The question is, perhaps the single question that we need to focus on in the month of Elul is, flows from the Ani L'day D'V'day D'Li, makes the statement, I am L'day. I make a statement in which I say to myself, Rabbeinu Shlomo, I am totally committed. I am your instrument. I do only that which you will. My rutzen, my agenda, my program, my goals, my whatever, are completely irrelevant. Only your agenda, only your program, only your goals, only your rutzen is meaning. If we can answer that question, I believe that we will have done with Elul what Elul is meant to do, and that at the conclusion of this Yitzira, which are the 40 days that began this past Sunday, and which will conclude with Yom Kippur, that when Yom Kippur comes along, and we've answered this question appropriately, that we will experience the Kabbalah Satera, the full suffusion or infusion of Torah that will at once tell us, that we will recognize that there's been a slicha, because as the Rambam says, we become a different entity. In the course of becoming a different entity, we become free, we become whole, we become infused with life in ways which we didn't dream existed in the past. Those options are open to us in Elul. They are the sound of the shofar. They are the effect of our having dispatched Moshe Rabbeinu to bridge the gap between what we understood at the beginning of Elul and what we will come to feel and to live at the conclusion of Yom Kippur.